The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Uttara Tantra teaching, The Buddha Treasure. Buddha is without beginning, middle, or end. He is peace itself, fully self-awakened and self-expanded in Buddhahood. Having reached this state, he shows the indestructible, permanent path so that those who have no realization may realize. Wielding the supreme sword and vajra of knowledge and compassionate love, he cuts the seedling of suffering and destroys the walls of doubt along with their surrounding thickets of various views. I bow down to this Buddha. Good afternoon. This is a teaching, this Uttara Tantra text, it's a shastra. So it's not a sutra, it's not purported to be by the Buddha. It's clearly a Mahayana text. And it's one of a series of teachings that was said to have been brought to us by Maitreya. Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. So in the sort of cosmology of Buddhism, the Buddha Shakyamuni was the Buddha of our time. And that at a certain point, Buddhism will be completely gone from anybody's consciousness. There'll be no sutras being read, no practice being taken up. And at that point, Maitreya will be born and become enlightened and be the next Buddha teaching. So there are a number of teachings said to have been brought down by Maitreya. In the Tibetan tradition, that's how this text is understood to have come to us. In Chinese Buddhism, it's understood to have come from a living master. And that's the way scholars see it. A Sangha is said to have harvested, we might say, this teaching from Maitreya. A Sangha was, along with Vasubandhu, helped to bring forth the Yogacara school, so he was a very important figure, a teacher, and he had a resolve to get these teachings from Maitreya so that we could study them. And he was going to have to do that by having a vision of Maitreya. And so he went into a retreat. One of the seniors, somebody recently told this story in a talk, I believe. So he went into a retreat to practice and center his practice on Maitreya and have these visions so he could receive these teachings. And he was going to dedicate himself for 12 years. And so after 3 years, he had had no experience of visions, no contact with Maitreya. He was getting discouraged, so he left. And as he was going down the mountain, he saw somebody brushing a feather across a huge rock and they in front of the house, in their house, and the Asanga said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I want to remove this rock because it's in the way." And so he thought, well, if he could do that, only 3 years. So he went back up the mountain and continued to practice. And after 3 more years, he still had no vision. So discouraged again, he went down the mountain. And as you might imagine, he saw someone who was polishing a long iron, thick iron bar with a silk scarf. And Asanga said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to make a needle out of this." So back up the mountain. And then finally, after 3 more years, he was completely discouraged. He left and saw somebody carrying bags of dirt from this huge mountain and depositing them over here. And he said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I don't like the mountain over there. I want it over here." So back up, and then finally, at the end of the 12 years with no results, he left and was decided that this was not to be. So he came across an old dog who was very old and sick and infested with maggots, and he was filled with such compassion for this dog that he decided he wanted to rid her of all of her maggots. But then he thought, but if I take the maggots off and just put them somewhere, they're going to die. So he cut a piece of flesh, put them down so the maggots would have something to eat. And then he thought, but if I pick them up with my fingers, then that might kill them. So he decided he would pick them up with his tongue. So as he went down to and so Asanga says, where have you been all this time? And Maitreya says, I've been here all along. He said, but because you had not fully developed your heart, you opened your heart and developed your compassion, you couldn't see me. He actually goes on to say, not only did I show you all of these signs every 3 years, but look, here on my robe. And he went to Maitreya's robe as a gesture of his compassion. This is not something that needs to be repeated. It was done once. So this is how in this tradition, this teaching has come down to us. So Buddha, the three treasures are, of course, the Buddha Dharma. You know, what is it that makes our meditation, our liturgy, these teachings, our practices, the precepts that we follow, the vows that we take, what makes them Buddha Dharma? Because it's not an irrelevant question, because Buddhism, in a sense, is not actually about Buddhism. The Buddha's path and teachings was not about Buddhism. It was about liberation. He was very clear about that, very simply clear about that. But he was developing a sangha. He was teaching and creating a path and laying the foundations for everything that followed. He knew that. He must have known that. He was dedicated the better part of his life doing that and creating that and leaving it so that it would continue to his disciples. But it's the three treasures that really makes all that we do, because those things are done in other traditions. There's meditation inside or outside of a tradition. There are teachings and liturgies and so on, practices, moral teachings. But what makes them Buddha Dharma is the three treasures. In fact, before we even know, if we're practicing Buddha Dharma, before we even sort of have a sense of or have taken refuge or have intimate contact with the three treasures, we are practicing them, if we're practicing Buddha Dharma. So the Buddha treasure is the Buddha, Shakyamuni, the awakened one, the enlightened one. And the dictionary in Buddhist terms says that the Sanskrit term for Buddha refers to opening, awakening, but opening like a flower. And in our time, in our period of Buddha Dharma, Shakyamuni was our awakened being. There were other enlightened beings before him. We chant their names, the past seven Buddhas before, when we chant the full lineage. Each a fully enlightened being, Buddha was awakened to what we call Buddha nature, right? Which is also not something, that's not the way the Buddha spoke of it. Buddha nature really came to its fruition in China, Chinese Buddhism. The sense of nature, Buddha nature, awakened natures, possessing that within ourselves, having the quality both of already having full possession of this awakened nature, this mind. It's not something that can be obtained from anywhere. No one is deficient. And that we have the potential to realize it. Both of those aspects. And so Buddha refers to Buddha Shakyamuni, historical Buddha, this human being who lived and died, and in the course of his life left home and studied with teachers and came to awakening and spent the whole of his life teaching and developing a Sangha, wholly dedicated to enlightening the minds of others. Because what in every generation people awaken to is Buddha mind, Buddha nature, that which we all possess, that they themselves are Buddha, then we can speak of all enlightened beings as Buddha. Because what enlightened beings enlighten to is the nature that everyone possesses, we can speak very broadly as all beings, all human beings, having being Buddha, having Buddha nature. Because all things, all phenomena, all animate and inanimate beings possess that same nature, we can speak most broadly as all things having the same nature, being Buddha. And so this is much more of a Mahayana broad view. Bodhidharma said that Buddha means aware, miraculously aware, to be awakened, to be aware, to be open up like a flower, is miraculous awareness. And I think it's significant that it's phrased that way, because awareness is something that everyone has. It's a word that is very common. We use it all the time. Are you aware? Are you aware of such and such? Do you have awareness about? But in Buddhism, it has a very particular meaning. It means awareness in the ordinary sense. Sometimes it means cognition. It means just knowing that you are sitting here listening. I am sitting here speaking. It can also point to the boundless and luminous awakened mind. Miraculous awareness. And miraculous is telling us that our ordinary sense of awareness. So when Buddhism says enlightenment is to see things as they really are, it's like, okay, I think I'm doing that. Right? So why, what's the deal? Why am I not enlightened? Or that even when my mind settles down and is not actively projecting thoughts, okay, now that must be the awareness. But every meditator has that experience and is not yet awakened, necessarily. And so what is Bodhidharma speaking about when he says miraculous awareness? He goes on to say, responding, perceiving, blinking your eyes, moving your hands and feet. This is all your miraculously aware nature. So in a way, he's inviting us in. He's saying, oh, telling us, oh, all of these ordinary activities, which is telling us that right here, right now, this miraculous awareness is present. But in a way, it can just make us more confused, because it's like, well, wait a minute. I'm doing those things. Everyone does those things. How does an enlightened being do those same things? Is it the same or different? If everyone has this awareness, it's present in each of us, then why, in being aware, is it not miraculous? Is that not my experience? Bodhidharma goes on to say, and this nature is the mind, and the mind is Buddha, and the Buddha is a path. This way is sublime. It can't be expressed in language. Echoing the same things the Buddha said after his enlightenment. In Tibetan Buddhism, the Buddha, the term for Buddha has two words. One means clarified, like when a stuffy room, when you open up all the windows and doors and all the fresh air comes in, freeing us of all habitual constricted patterns. The second word means expansion, blossoming. One teacher said, has a sense of being splendid. So Buddha is to perceive things as they are, to be awakened, and then in a way that is both expansive and expanding at the same time. And so here in the Uttara Tantra teaching, it says, Buddha is without beginning, middle, or end. He, Buddha, Shakyamuni, is peace itself, fully self-awakened, self-expanded in Buddhahood, in the living, embodied, enlightened experience of Buddhahood. Having reached this state, he shows us the indestructible, permanent path so that those who have no realization may realize, wielding the supreme sword of Vajra and Vajra of knowledge and compassionate love. He cuts the seedling, all the many seedlings of our suffering, and destroys the walls of doubt along with their surrounding thickets of views. I bow down to this Buddha. So the Buddha Shakyamuni was born of a mother and father, of parents, just like us. He grew up, he left home, he studied, was enlightened, taught, and died. That which is Buddha did not begin with Shakyamuni, or his practice, or his enlightenment. Buddha, in this way, is not a person, not a thing. Buddha Shakyamuni was self-awakened into selflessness. And this is a very important point that is made in Buddhism, self-awakened. Now, in the Buddha's own time, there were many of his disciples that came to enlightenment. So what was the difference between those disciples and the Buddha? Well, one difference was that they came to enlightenment within the study of a Buddha, with a Buddha. Whereas the Buddha had teachers in his earlier path, but did not come to awakening with him, was not studying Buddha Dharma. So his brilliance, I think of it as a kind of genius, a spiritual genius, was that he was able to not only come to awakening, self-awaken, right? Without any precedent, without any teachings to turn to, without any texts. I mean, we have 2,500 years. So like, what's our excuse? Right? I mean, think about it. He was just out there. He was just out there in a landscape where lots of people were searching, lots of people were looking. There were communities, there were teachers. And he engaged some of them. He practiced ascetic practices, sort of beyond our imagination, what he did, and left all of those and came to this place of self-awakening. So not only was he able to come to that awakening on his own, but he was able to guide himself. He knew what he was directing his own practice, right? He knew what he needed to be doing, how he needed to be working with his mind in a way that had to be self-knowing, right? It had to be an awareness that he had in his mind, but it also had to be taking him beyond any conceptual thought. Otherwise, he would have never come to awakening. So think about that. He was able to guide himself without precedent, without an example, and have a sense of how what he needed to be doing up to and beyond the point where he could actually guide himself, where it was any longer conceptual. So being self-awakened means he didn't come to awakening through any kind of external force. So no deity, no other teachers, no agent, the guidance of a teacher. He didn't rely upon God or gods, empowerments, training, practice, well, his own practice. Whereas we, and all of us who have followed in the Buddha's footsteps, we do train, we do practice. We study with teachers, we study the teachings, such as this. We have all of this to draw upon. But in a very real sense, we also need to self-awaken. Because with all of that that we have available to us, there is a point for each of us, and not just once, but over and over and over again, like during this week, where our practice gets to the point where that is beyond self-guidance, self-awareness, conceptual thinking, and that our practice is continuing, is moving in and beyond as though on its own, right? Without any external or even conscious guidance. That's how we come to awakening, in a moment where there is no duality, there is no subject and object, no student and teaching or student and practice. So in that way, that understanding of self-awakening and then self-expanding, we continue to practice, we continue to train, right? We don't just have an insight and then realize that we are realized and completely awakened, because we realize we're not. We realize that something has been seen, which is Buddha, and we still get caught, and false views still arise, and the self still asserts itself and has power. And so self-expanding in this way is continuing to move forward. Right? As Dogen said, when we begin to understand and have intimate contact, then we realize something is missing. Not in a deficient way. It's not a flaw. It's not anything in any insecurity. It's not anything that is missing. It's the nature of the path and human nature that there is more. Buddha is peace itself. The Buddha Shakyamuni was peace himself. Buddha awareness is peace itself. So think about it. When you're practicing, like during this week, and you're experiencing your meditation, your mind, your thoughts, things that arise, sensations, emotions, memories, and even if they're still arising, there's a recognition that they arise within a deepening experience of peace. In other words, the reactivity, the harshness, the judgment, the anger, the irritation, any of the ways that we would react that are not peaceful, begin to calm. And even as similar things keep arising, we have the experience that there is a quality of peace which is present, right? Which is developing. That is not an accident. We are coming close to and beginning to touch what this teaching says. The Buddha is peace itself. Buddha awareness is peace itself. It's really a sign that we are coming closer and that we possess that within us. You know, the Buddha said, the world may quarrel with me. I do not quarrel with the world. And we can think of that as actively quarreling, but we can also understand that at a much deeper level. The Buddha, being peace himself, is not in a state of conflict with the world. All the world may be in a state of conflict with itself, with him. In fact, there's a sutra that I came across, an early sutra in the Pali Canon, where a Brahmin who had been a Brahmin formerly became ordained and was very unhappy about something and seemed to involve the Buddha. So he came to the Buddha very angry and unhappy, and approaching the Buddha began to abuse him and criticize him in foul and harsh words. And thus reviled, the sutra said, the Buddha said to the Brahmin, "Well, Brahmin, do friends and confidants and relatives and family and guests ever visit you?" So you can imagine him thinking, "What? What are you asking me?" And the Brahmin says, "Yes, Gotama, sometimes friends and confidants, relatives, family, and so on, do visit me. And the Buddha says, well, do you not offer them snacks or food or tidbits? And he says, yes, I do. Sometimes I do. And the Buddha says, what if they don't accept them? Who gets them after that? And the Brahmin says, if they don't accept them, I get them back. They belong to me. And the Buddha said, even so, as you abuse us who do not abuse, as you are angry with us, maybe he was reviling the whole Sangha, as you are angry with us who do not get angry, you are quarreling with us who do not quarrel with you. All this is yours. All of this belongs to you. It all comes back to you. When one instead abuses back when abused, repays anger in kind, quarrels back when quarreled with, associating with each other and exchanging mutually, this continues that karma. He said, this mutual exchange we do not engage in. And so this then, of course, as practitioners, brings forth the question of how do we, when meeting anger, criticism, all of the things that we can so easily get angry and defensive and critical about, and may very well need to respond to, how do we do that without perpetuating the very thing that we are receiving and the suffering that we are seeing in front of us? And so the text says that the Buddha, this being peace itself, is wielding the great sword and vajra of knowledge, the sword that cuts through all of our delusions and enlightens us to our Buddha mind and brings forth the great compassion. Because what is it that dampens our compassion? What is it that constricts our heart? What is it that brings forth our greed, anger, delusion, our pride, our jealousy, all the things that we turn outwards and inflict upon others while we inflict them upon ourselves? Is our attachment to the self. The Buddha realized that without that attachment and all of the sort of universes of emotional and mental proliferation that comes out of that, that can only come out, that must come out of that view, that sense of a separate, self-existing, independent, permanent self. I am this, this is me, this is mine, the Buddha said. Without that, what is the reference for all of those kleshas? Where does it all come back to? Who is being defended? Who is being hurt? Where does it all land when there is no place of abiding? Which is a good way to recognize. In the Faith Mind, it says, when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace will be disturbed. So one way of looking at that is when my mind is disturbed, when I am disturbed, there is something true that I am not understanding and something false and not acting upon or living out of and something false that I am also that I am understanding and acting out of. It's not that I have no understanding, but the understanding that I have is leading me, is a necessary sort of scaffolding from which everything that I'm experiencing is coming forth. Without that, this would not be. And so when that begins to be seen through and even just calm in that, those experiences of opening our hearts and experiencing more peace within ourselves, that's the natural development of our compassion. that is present within every single person, but does need, for most of us, does need good conditions internally and externally for that to be brought forth, right? It's just like as babies, as infants, right? Every infant needs, and whether you're an infant baby, whether you're an infant seedling, whether you're an infant squirrel, whether you're an infant moon, right? Every infant, every birthing thing needs conducive circumstances and conditions to nurture that being so they can open like a flower. And as long as there is enough present, it will grow. But it may grow in ways that are not bringing forth its full potential. And so we may have a human life. We may grow up and be a person and live a person's life. But that heart that is naturally our own compassionate heart may not have been brought forth. The text goes on to say, being uncreated and spontaneously present, not a realization due to extraneous conditions, the wielding of knowledge, compassionate love, and ability. Buddhahood has the qualities of the two benefits, benefiting ourselves and others. And within the bodhisattva path, which is so strong about compassionate for others, putting others first, right? Putting others before ourselves. That the understanding is always there that you too are benefiting. In fact, Buddhism understands we will naturally put ourselves forward. We will naturally seek to benefit ourselves. Now, sometimes the way we do that gets very distorted. It's all topsy-turvy. Because we are confusing pleasure with pain. We are confusing happiness with suffering. So benefiting ourselves is implicit and really explicit within the path. And within the Mahayana, that's just not enough. And it's not enough because it's being stingy or greedy, although it can be, because it is not yet fully manifesting Buddha. That until we really understand that our lives are inextricably bound together, this mutuality, that the idea of self-liberation alone without others being liberated, right? That there can be joy and happiness and liberation within ourselves. But then there are ways in which that will be limited, right? Until we are actively working for the benefit of others. And so being uncreated and spontaneously present, I mean, think about that. So the Buddha said all conditioned existence is dukkha, can lead to suffering because it's impermanent and we grasp and then we're disappointed because we lose it. Being uncreated and spontaneously present. It cannot be created, Buddha, that which we are practicing to realize, your own self-nature, your own awakened mind, your miraculous awareness. It cannot be created. It can never be destroyed. It is never apart. It is always spontaneously present, which means it's never absent. It's never missing. Now, if you're anything like me, there have probably been moments where you were pretty sure it was missing, right? and you had in front of you a whole like case study of how of, to be able to prove that, right? How that must be so. But it ain't so. Almost certainly, that's why these teachings are presented over and over and over and over and over and over and over. Whenever we encounter a teaching that is reiterated over and over in all of the across all of these different teachings, all these different traditions, or when we hear the Buddha or a teacher say, without this, practice and realization is not possible, we should stop. We should stop and pay attention to what's being said. Right? There's a reason why certain teachings are reiterated over and over and over again. Right? We need to hear them. Right? We need to hear them, one, because they may be difficult to hear, difficult to understand. Right? There's much about Buddhism that is actually, in a certain sense, very simple because it's already you, but can be difficult because it's really talking about the most complicated thing in the world, which is you and me and every human being. And also because we probably doubt that that's true. And so spontaneously present means it's here without our effort, spontaneously. You don't make it happen. It's appearing in every moment completely, which means practice and realization is never not possible. I mean, just think about that. Because we tend to think, you know, oh, there's no way I can even do meditation, much less anything else. Right? We've already decided. It's like we have this standard of measurement that we bring to different aspects of practice and think, well, without that, this is not possible. I have to be in a certain mood. I have to have certain energy. My mind has to be a certain state. Things around me have to be just so. And one of the not unintended aspects of training is we don't get to choose. Right? We don't actually wait. It's like whenever those perfect situations are present for you, come on into the Zendo. It's all yours. Right? And if we don't see you here, we'll just know that hasn't happened yet. No, not quite. Right? That we find ourselves in the Zendo in all kinds of states where we would, left to ourselves, likely think, what is the point, right? I should wait. I should do something else until. But we're actually practicing in accord with this teaching. Even now, it is spontaneously present. It is never not possible. It is never not here. And that is true for every aspect of practice, for our mindfulness, for our ability to bring forth aspiration and intention, for our capacity to practice the precepts, to bring forth compassion. That's why some of the most important times to practice are when you think it's not possible. Thomas Merton said, love, within the Christian tradition, love and prayer are learned. When prayer is impossible and your heart is turned to stone, that's when you learn something about love and prayer. It's not the only time, but it is a most important time. Now, of course, we benefit from good conditions, and so we do sesshin. And we set it up in a very particular way to create conducive and a conducive environment internally and externally. But it's important because we're not always doing sesshin, right? That we practice in as many different conditions as possible. Particularly when we think, this is not the time. You know, in our mind, we think, this is not practice. This is not Dharma. This is not the path. Whether consciously or unconsciously, just by the way, we've sort of forgotten. And so to notice the many times and places and situations where we do perhaps actively forget to practice, where we think, you know, I'll get back to that when. So that we may wield knowledge, bring forth our understanding, bring forth our compassion. So metta practices are to, within sort of the safety, relative safety of your own body and mind, to begin to extend loving kindness, first towards those that are within your safety net, right? No big challenge, because you've already included this person or these people. But then you begin to extend it. But you're in a place of safety. You're just sitting on your cushion. But you're bringing forth in your mind those with whom you don't feel compassion. So you leave that circle, or you extend that circle. You expand. You self-expand. You make your field larger. And the strength of your meditation, if you do that strongly, that is, you really are focused, you're really practicing it as meditation, and there's mindfulness, your concentration is strong, and you're seeing that person, or you're seeing those people, and they are real to you, and you know because you are feeling whatever that person conjures up for you. And then you are bringing forth that compassion. That's how we are developing this compassionate love, right? But it's all within your choosing, right? You're in charge. And that's part of the power of that practice, is you're in charge of that. And so then you can experiment. For all of those moments when you won't be in charge, not of who's in front of you, not of who, of how they're responding, like this Brahmin with the Buddha, and so in that way, we don't need to wait. We don't need to wait for the right time or place. We don't need to be anxious about losing anything. It's like when we have a good meditation or good session and we're already anxious because we know we're going to lose it, right? It's like going on vacation. You know, you've been looking forward to it, you're planning, it's going to be a great week, but you're already thinking, oh, it's going to get over, it's going to be over, right? It's not going to last forever. It's your mind's already there. You know, Gokhan in his talk on Sunday was talking about impermanence. You know, impermanence is not like a bummer, right? It's not like the bad news. Oh, I have something bad, really hard to tell you. Better sit down. Nothing lasts. As Gokhan said, it's just the way the things are. The Buddha is just reporting. He went in to that deep place, that inner chamber, and came back and said, this is what I saw. And it's not just me. And it's not just Buddha Dharma, it's not just Buddhism, other people, other traditions, other practices have seen this. So we don't have to be afraid of losing it. No one's going to steal it from you. It can't be deprived. It will never be destroyed. It is unconditioned. And it is also not something that you have to be super clever and have all your ducks lined up in just the right way to make it work, because you're going to make it happen. Right? You're going to make this, and it all hinges on you. It does, but not in the way we think. because it is uncreated and spontaneously present, never absent, because it is present with everyone, doesn't belong to anyone, because it is not the actual result of any effort, although much effort needs to be applied. Why? Because we have been applying so much effort our whole lives building up the world we call samsara. And not just building it up like the inner workings, the machinations, but the philosophy, the beliefs, right? The preface, the table of contents, the indexes, the glossary, it's all there, right? And we've devoted so much energy, and of course we've had a lot of help, and we look around and it looks like everybody's doing it, right? So that is a mighty, mighty force or forces that by the point we come into practice are kind of humming along in their all is suffering kind of way. And we'll keep doing so because we will keep applying ourselves to the inner workings and believing in the philosophy and the ideology and keep adding new chapters. They're not really that new, really. But we always have more to say. You know, it's like the novel you've read, and it's like, oh, this is so great. And it's like, oh, this will be the perfect ending, but it's not over. And then there's another one, there's another one. It's like not knowing when to stop. And so without effort, those karmic habits will just continue. And so we practice. Here we are. And all the while in a state of peace. That is our nature. That in and of itself is not quarreling with the world. It's not quarreling with others. It's not quarreling with ourselves. And this it is not something. And so to talk about Buddha nature, to talk about Buddha, to talk about miraculous awareness, it's just the nature of language that it's things, right? It creates an object for our subject. So we just have to keep remembering that it's not so. Miraculous awareness is Buddha responding, perceiving, blinking your eyes, moving your hands and feet. It's all your miraculous aware nature. So what do we do during sesshin? We move our hands and feet a little. We blink our eyes. We eat, chew, swallow, wash, sit, stand. Very basic actions. All your miraculously aware nature. And so that's what makes them practices, is to enter in to that practice, to self-awaken without any external force, which means observers, witnesses, judges, juries, executioners, whatever you might bring to the party. Let them rest. They need a rest too. They've been working so hard. It reminded me of the master who called out every morning and say, "Oh Master, oh Buddha, yes. Are you awake? Yes. Do not be deceived. I will not." Who is this Buddha?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.